So you'll see today, the topic is what is truth? And I want to explore the history and the concept of truth. So before we get to that, let me just kind of back up a little bit and explain why do a class on this. So the age that we're currently living in is a secular age. Everybody know what secularism is? Just start with that question. When I say a secular age, what do you think I mean by that?
Not related to religion?
Yeah, good. Not related to religion? What did you say, Chris?
I don't want the same ones. Age that doesn't absorb the authority of God.
Yeah. Secularism is the separation or rejection of religion from society at just about every level. And that's true for us today. So government, education, the justice system, news media, etc., where religion, and particularly Christianity in the Western world, was once embraced and accepted as part of society, it is now seen as something that's optional, something personal, one choice across a spectrum of other religious and spiritual beliefs, okay? And we'll talk more about that in a second. But because we've been thoroughly secularized, Christianity is not only seen as optional, but even inappropriate to practice or integrate in your own workplace or setting. So give you an example. How many in the room work in a non-ministry, non-Christian environment? Okay. If you were to go to your to a conference meeting next week, and before your supervisor started the meeting, you stopped and said, "Hey, I'd like to open us up with a word of prayer." Do you think that that would be received with maybe that would be received well, but even some of you thinking about that, like, kind of cringe at the thought of doing that. Am I wrong? We can be honest here. You kind of cringe a little bit and be like, oh, like we're praying. That's secularism. That's the result of secularism. We've divorced religion from every aspect of society, including the workplace. Now, I'm not going to talk about whether that's something you should do or not. We can talk about that later. All I'm doing is proving a point. The fact that we even feel, even as Christians in this room, that to go into a place like a conference meeting and say, "Hey, let's pray before this," and that kind of like, ugh. You know, like feels a little bit weird, and you know, there would probably be an air of awkwardness around everybody else in the room, means that we are thoroughly secularized. Does that make sense? So we need to understand this, and we need to understand that we're dealing with what Francis Schaeffer called a tale of two stories. So not story as in like The Hobbit, like that has a beginning, middle, and end, and you're telling a story. Stories as in levels. So here's where we are today. And again, I'm taking this from Schaeffer, but we have an upper story and a lower story. And I believe Piercy talks about this a little bit in her book. The upper story is the non-rational, the subjective, the preferential. It's about taste. And here we have politics, we have aesthetics, we have ethics, and we have religion and theology. Now that's interesting. So we've gone from, at one time, like understanding religion to be, or even by proxy Christianity, as something that's true and objective, to now it's something that is more preferential, that it's that it's when we're interacting and engaging with our neighbors, Christianity is like taste-based, right? If you've had conversations with people, we've basically put religion on the level of your favorite flavor of ice cream. You like vanilla, I like chocolate. You believe in angels. I believe in science. You worship Jesus. I worship Buddha or whatever. It's a spectrum. It's in this upper story now. It's subjective, right? Whereas the lower story in Schaeffer is the rational, the objective, the knowable. This is where our society, this is where we put physics. This is where we put mathematics, biology, history. These things are factual. These are things that we can know. At one point, religion and theology was here, and we've moved it up here. And so what I want to kind of do today is lay the foundation a little bit. We're not going to get very far, but to show how the metaphysical, does everybody know what I mean by metaphysical? What's metaphysical? Anyone? The metaphysical is simply this. Metaphysical is that which is beyond reality, that which is beyond nature, right? It's the things that we can't see with our five senses. It's beyond the physical world. That's the metaphysical. The metaphysical has been relegated in Western society and Western culture to the upper story. Make sense? So let me look here. Here's the problem with that. The problem is that when we relegate theology and Christianity and the metaphysical to the upper story, you're going to lose some things in the process, okay? You lose any sense of the divine, okay? The metaphysical deals with first principles. It deals with concepts of being, the nature of the divine. It deals with reality outside the observable universe. So doing theology is a metaphysical exercise. And when you have a society that rejects that story, you're going to lose any sense of what the divine is. But not only that, when you don't just lose belief in God, you lose belief in anything that's transcendental. And so that's why we're doing a class on this, because I believe that because we have relegated religion and theology to this upper story here, we've lost a sense of truth. We've lost a sense of goodness. We've lost a sense of beauty. We've lost a sense of these metaphysical transcendental realities. And therefore, we're like suspended in midair. Everything's based on taste. Everything's based on preference. What's true for you is not only what's true for me, right? This is like such a popular thing to say. Like, I don't watch the show often, but like on The Bachelor, they talk about like, you have to speak your truth. Like, you just have to go to him and speak your truth. It's like, what is that? Your truth? As if we own it? As if we have some kind of possession of our, I've got just my truth about my feelings and you have your, and we need to like speak our truth to each other. It's like, no, there's true and there's false. We have to get back to a place where Christianity and religion and theology can be put on the rational, the objective, the knowable, because friends, that's where it is. That's where it is. If it's up here, then like, I feel like we have to say with Paul, let's eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Like the resurrection doesn't matter. But if the resurrection is true, if it's rational, if it's objective, then all of Christianity is here, right? So that's why we have to kind of start with truth. Truth is going to be the foundational basis of a good, healthy worldview. If we can say that things are true and things are false, we're already in a good place, right? So that's what we're going to do today. Are there any questions about that? Let me make sure I hit everything here. That's really what we're doing today. It's like we're going beyond. We're going to the realm of the beyond. We're going to the metaphysical, and we're saying there are realities out there that are beyond the five senses, that are beyond the physical world. That is Christianity. Christianity says this world is true. but it also says that there is a God who is real and invisible and cannot be detected with the five senses, right? All right. So here's how we'll begin. I want to do a broad overview history of truth because it takes quite the leap to go from things are real, things are rational, things are true, to I have my own truth, you have your own truth. We begin with Jesus before Pontius Pilate. This is John 18. Jesus is standing before Pilate, and he's accused of rebellion against the Roman Empire. He's accused of inciting a religious insurrection. And Pilate asks Jesus, he's kind of questioning him, and he says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "You have said so." And Pilate goes, "So you're a king then?" And this is what Jesus says. He says, "For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." And Pilate says, "What is truth?" So this is a question that was relevant. It's relevant today, and it was relevant to Pilate. How do we know what is true? What is truth? Now, it's important because Pilate's asking that from a particular cultural perspective. And so here's how I want to begin our venture into the history of truth. There is a group of philosophers called the pre-Socratics. Socratic is short for Socrates. In the Western world is where they were in Greece. This is kind of like the very beginning of philosophy, okay? So the pre-Socratics, the philosophers, this is around, we date them around 500 BC, okay? They begin to look around the world and they start asking some questions. And they don't necessarily ask what's true. Instead, they're looking at the world and they go, "What is all of this made of? What is the stuff that this is made of?" And the first philosopher ever named Thales comes along, and Thales says, "I've got it. I know what the one substance is that's holding the world together. It's water." Water. That was his belief. He says, "Water's the perfect candidate for a unifying substance." Why? Because we need it to live, right? Got to drink water to stay alive. Water can change temperatures. You can freeze it. You can boil it. And it can turn into a solid, liquid, or gas, and it still be water. So there's nothing else in the universe like water. Water is the thing that holds everything together. Water is where we came from. It's the origin of everything, right? But then another philosopher comes along named Heraclitus. And Heraclitus says, "Look, I agree with you that there is got to be some underlying thing that holds everything together, but it's not water." And this isn't factual, but Heraclitus, the way he basically proves him wrong is he's like, "You can't step in the same river twice. You can call a river by the same name, like say, you know, this is the Mississippi River. But if I step into the Mississippi River once and then I take my foot out of it and then I step into that river again, it's not the same body of water. The water is always flowing." And so what Heraclitus is going to say is that the world is dominated by constant change. There's change everywhere. There's chaos. And here's why I bring up Heraclitus. Heraclitus, for him, change is fundamental to reality. And the element that he's going to say is what makes up everything in the world is not water, but instead he's going to say it's fire. And that makes sense because fire is constantly changing. Fire's constantly moving. You can't produce the same fire twice. Fire's everywhere. And so in order to metaphorically speak about fire, Heraclitus believes in the gods. He believes in Zeus. And he attributes a word to talk about fire. And the word is logos. Logos. You can also say logos if you want to like get the Greek right. But he uses this word logos, and it's the first place in Western philosophical writing that we see this word. Okay? Now, put the word in your pocket because we're going to come back to it. We're going to see this word again. But that's how he understands fire. He says change is governed by a transcendent law of logos, and it's what Zeus and the other gods use to implement constant change in the world, like fire. So that's the first place that we see logos introduced into the ideas of the Western world. Okay, so I don't want to talk too much on the pre-Socratic philosophers, but just know this about them. They're looking around the world and they're saying there has to be some sort of something that's holding everything together. That's what the pre-Socratics are saying. There has to be some element. Some of them thought it was air. Some of them thought it was the earth, the ground itself. They're saying something has to hold all of this together. It just has to. Like they're using their minds and they're saying it's got to be something. Okay. Then you have Socrates, and Socrates is important because he looks at the pre-Socratic philosophers before him and he goes, that's interesting. That's really important. So what does it mean to be a good person? In other words, Socrates doesn't really care about what it is that the pre-Socratics are talking about. Socrates is a rabble-rouser. Socrates is going to go around asking questions. That's really what Socrates gives and contributes to Western philosophy. He wanted to know what was ethical, what was moral. So if you're a parent and you have kids here and your child comes up to you and says, why is the sky blue? And you say, because of like the atmosphere or whatever. Well, why is that? Because it rains and whatever, the weather patterns. Well, why? Because it has to be. It's blue. Like, what? God made the sky. It's blue. Well, why did he make it blue? This is the Socratic method. Socrates asked why to all of his interlocutors to the point where they said, please stop, and they ended up putting him to death. They accused him of questioning the Athenian government, and they said this guy's just really loud, and we've got to get rid of him because he won't stop asking why. That's a very legendary way to put it. But just know that Socrates is important because he's going to encourage all of his pupils and all of his students to question everything. He's going to make them question why. So, that's Socrates. After Socrates, we have Plato. And Plato is huge. Plato's important. He is Socrates' most bright student, and he's the one that's going to like write down stuff about Socrates because Socrates didn't write a book. Plato's where we even get knowledge and information of Socrates. But Plato's going to come along and he's going to say, yeah, I kind of want to talk about like what these guys were talking about up here. Because that is more interesting to me than like ethics and being a good person. Though Plato does write about that as well. But for our purpose today, Plato is going to introduce a new concept to philosophy called the realm of ideas. These are also called Plato's forms. So here's kind of what Plato's going to do. Plato's going to say, the pre-Socratics are asking the right questions, okay? They're asking, what is the world, what is the universe made of? However, if I close my eyes, let's use an example of an apple, okay? If I see and discover an apple before me, I can look at that apple, I can see what it's made of, I can touch it, I can grasp it, and I can say that the apple exists in the real world. However, I can also close my eyes and picture an apple, and I can picture the perfect, most ideal form of that apple. And what Plato is going to say is that the cognitive ability for a human being to close their eyes and picture the form of an apple in their brains is just as real as the apple itself. Do you follow? He's going to say there exists a realm of ideas. There exists a realm of forms that when I picture an apple, that picturing of the apple exists in a perfect form. Use another example. A circle. That's not a perfect circle. But if I close my eyes and I can picture a perfect circle, that means that there is a world in which there is a perfect circle. There is a realm out there where there is a perfect curvature of a circle. Does that make sense? This is what Plato is going to contribute. This is how Plato is going to understand truth itself. So what he's saying here is something that the pre-Socratics weren't saying, is that he's saying there's a reality that transcends the physical reality that we can see. There's a reality where there is a perfect apple, and there's a reality where there is a perfect circle. And there's and what he's going to say is that reality is where we get truth, right? Truth exists out there. Now, Plato believed in a kind of God, but it definitely not the Christian God or even Yahweh at this point. And he's going to have his own ideas about the divine, but what we need to know is, for Plato, is that he's going to introduce this idea, a world of forms, okay? Everyone good so far? Plato, reality, forms, ideas. Plato also has a student named Aristotle. This is Plato's best student. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Here comes Aristotle. Aristotle comes in and says, okay, I see what you're doing here. I see that what you're doing, he says, you're basically saying that there's a difference between the object and an idea of an object, right? The difference between the apple that I can see, the object, and the ideal form of the apple. Aristotle is going to say, but I don't quite agree with it. He's going to say there is such a thing as essence, which is where Plato says is in the realm of the ideas. He's like, I agree that there is an essence of the apple, but the essence of that object is in the thing itself. Interesting. He's not saying that if you cut open the apple, you'll find the essence of the apple. He wasn't a materialist. Instead, he's saying that the ideal and the physical can't be separated. You can't separate the idea from the object. Aristotle's going to say, The substance of the idea is the object. What does that mean? What does that mean? What is it? What does it mean that the idea, to demonstrate this, he talks about, he applies it to all kinds of things. He says, like, if you take this desk here, he says that the form of the desk is its shape, but the matter is the wood itself. That's the essence of it, right? He does the same thing with abstract ideas like letters and words. He says letters and syllables are the form of a word, right? And the word is the matter or material or the essence of those letters and syllables. Does that make sense? Here's what you need to know, okay? What's the point? The important thing is that while Plato and Aristotle disagreed on the location of how forms relate to objects, what they agreed upon was that the reality, that reality is not material, but composed of ideas. That there's a reality of material and there's a reality of ideas. That's what Plato and Aristotle are going to say. Here's why this is important, okay? And by the way, this is called realism. That's what they believed. Okay, here's why this is important. I want to hit that, but I want to make sure we keep going here. Aristotle's student, his brightest student, is Alexander the Great. Anybody know what Alexander the Great did?
Conquered
like a lot of stuff, right? Like all of Europe and Western Europe and most of Asia. And the reason that's important is because these Greek ideas, which is called Hellenism, spread all throughout the region. So by the time we get to the New Testament, Greco-Roman world, first century Palestine, these ideas were very prevalent among both Jews and Gentiles, because the Jews were very much Hellenized at this point. So that's why knowing this is important. Aristotle is also going to mention this idea that Heraclitus, our friend Heraclitus, talked about of logos. But Aristotle is going to use it in the form of persuasion, rationality. So Aristotle is going to say that logos, the use of logos involves reasoning, evidence, rational arguments. Ethos is going to appeal to goodness and virtue, and pathos is going to appeal to the emotion of the person. And Aristotle is going to say, someone who's persuasive uses all three. Someone who's good at rhetoric, someone who's good at speaking, is going to be someone who's good at using logic, using ethics, goodness, virtue, and appealing to the emotion of a person. Again, that's going to be important. And here's why. Now we're getting to Christianity and truth. Okay? So, where should I put this? Christianity. Christianity is going to come along. And the Apostle John is going to basically do a Michael Jordan with logos. He's going to use the concept of logos. Like Jordan is the best basketball player of all time, right? We have to agree. He's the best, undisputed. I don't want to hear LeBron. There were other basketball players before Michael Jordan, though, right? There are other basketball players that could dribble the ball, like Magic Johnson, Larry Bird. They knew the fundamentals of the game. They could put it in the hoop really well. But it's Michael Jordan who did things that we've never seen before with a basketball, right? The way that he played. The Apostle John is about to do something we've never seen before with the logos, okay? So logos up to this point means this. And it was a common word. It means word. It means reason. It means logic. It means principle. It means wisdom. Okay? But John is going to do something that is just insane with logos. Okay? He's going to do something unbelievable with it. He's going to begin his gospel, and he's going to say, in the beginning was the logos. And the logos was with God. And if you're a Greek philosopher up to this point, you hear that and you go, okay, I'm tracking with that. Logos with God. But then he says, and the logos was God. The logos was God. And you go, whoa, what is he saying here? Remember, Heraclitus, Plato, Aristotle, logos is this divine reason that stood beside the transcendent of the gods. How is John using it? John's saying the logos was in the beginning with God. He's saying the logos is God. He was God in the beginning. So firstly, the logos is eternally existent with God. Okay? Secondly, the logos is the instrument with which God created the world. This is John 1:3. All things were made through him, that is the logos, and without him was not anything that was made. So God's using the logos to create. He's using the logos, he's using it as a means, an instrument of creation. And thirdly, the logos is God's word. That's the mind-blowing part. This is a quote from Jordan Cooper here. He says it better than I do. He says, what is so radically different in John's exposition of the logos from that of the Greek philosophers is that for John, this divine word actually becomes flesh. This divine word is a person. While the Greeks generally viewed knowledge of truth through a process of ascent from the material world to the universal forms, think Plato, in the incarnation, this is reversed, right? In the person of Jesus, the eternal logos descended into our material reality by taking on flesh. The general and non-physical has become the particular and the material. So truth, in its fullest sense, is accessible. This is why Jesus can stand before his disciples and blatantly say, he is the truth. I am the way, I am the truth. He's going to say that in John 14. Paul expounds on this further as he confesses that in Christ are found all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge and the fullness of the Godhead. So in the logos, the God-man, truth is personal. It is essential to recognize that truth is not at its core merely a set of facts, but a transcendent and eternal God. That's mind-blowing. That's mind-blowing that the logos is the immaterial, the idea of truth that Plato's talking about, that we can conceive that something is true, has now become true, has now become physical, has now entered into the world, right? How you doing? How is that? Does this make sense? Okay, this is very, very deep. But we need to understand this. This idea of logos is so, so crucial to understanding truth. In Christianity, truth is both an objective, immaterial reality, and it's embodied in the person of Christ. So as Christians, we believe in true things, right? We believe in true propositions. I'm standing here. That's truth. But truth is also a person. Truth is also divine. It's embodied in the person of Christ. That's what makes this so crazy. Because for philosophers, reason was not seen as personal. And though it was seen, though for them, reason was seen as eternal and timeless, like truth was eternal and timeless, it was never seen as equal with God, right? It was something that the gods used to play with and start fires with and to create change with. Let me see if I want to cover this. Fundamental elements, the order of the world. Here's the reality and the logos. I'm not going to say that. That's a lot of wordy word words. Truth in the Christian confession is grounded upon God. Okay? So when we begin with truth as Christians, we're grounding it in the logos, and it's known most fully through the incarnate Christ. So we can know truth, we can reason about truth, we can picture it, its ideal forms, but we're not going to know the truth, we're not going to know the divine truth without having our mind awakened by the Spirit of God and knowing Christ fully. Does that make sense? That's the Christian kind of worldview of truth, and we'll get into definitions next week. So after the death and resurrection of Christ, after this idea of logos in Christianity, nothing was the same. Nothing could ever be the same in philosophy after the logos coming true. The game is changed. And we have a lot of Christian philosophers coming afterwards. So you have men like Justin Martyr, who wrote a lot about the logos. He's a patristic church father. You have Irenaeus, Origen, Tertullian. All these men wrote about truth. Boethius, really good one, underrated. The most important thinker on truth in the early church is a man, let's see, well, this one, right? By the name of, no. Saint Augustine. Saint Augustine. There's probably no one more influential as it pertains to doctrine and theology outside of Paul than Augustine. Augustine is just huge in understanding truth itself. So Augustine... lived from about 354 to 430. He's radically converted. He's heavily influenced before his conversion by Plato. That's important. So a lot of Plato's ideas are present in Augustine, and we'll see that in a second. Augustine said this about truth. He said, "Where I found truth, there found I my God, who is the truth itself." So he's basically saying, when I finally arrived at truth, the true truth, I found God, because he's truth itself. This isn't just poetic for Augustine. And what's interesting is that Augustine is actually going to argue for the very existence of God from truth. He's going to make an argument for God from the concept of truth. This is where it gets a little bit heady, okay? He wrote a book called On the Free Choice of Will, in which he explores the ideas of free will, predestination, foreknowledge, all of those things, human responsibility. But there's a little slice of the book where Augustine kind of goes on a diatribe about truth. And he begins making an argument for God to his interlocutor based on the existence of timeless eternal truths. You remember this lower story up here. Mathematics for Augustine is quite firmly in the lower story. And Augustine is going to call the truths that we learn from mathematics as eternal truths. He's going to say, for instance, 2 + 2 = 4. For Augustine, that truth is eternal. Interesting. Okay, stay with me here. This truth is eternal because it's not dependent on the changing circumstances of the physical world. It's not dependent on the past, the present, or the future. It's a truth that holds everywhere for everyone at all times. Okay? So to be sure, he's going to say that human beings can think these truths in the time that they're in, but the truth themselves never change. That's step one, okay? This is true whether you and I exist or not. Whether we're born or we're not born, 2 + 2 = 4. Always has, and it always has been that way, okay? That's step one. Now, Augustine's going to say, ask yourself, how could a human mind produce an eternal truth, a truth like 2 + 2 = 4? Augustine's going to say that 2 + 2 = 4 is not produced by the human mind, but instead it's discovered by the human mind. Does that make sense? The human mind, we can't make this up. We wouldn't have never thought of this on our own. Instead, we have to discover 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, that's important. And here's what Augustine says. It's an eternal truth, unchanging. It's an unchanging truth, right? Augustine will look at this and he'll say, here's the problem. The human mind is subject to change. We can change our minds. So how can we know that 2 + 2 = 4 is true if we're changing our minds all the time, right? Dilemma. He says, if truth were equal to our minds, it would be subject to change. Our minds sometimes seem more and sometimes less. And because of this, we acknowledge that they are mutable. Truth remaining in and of itself does not gain anything when we see it or lose anything when we do not see it. So he's basically saying the truth doesn't matter whether we see it or whether we don't see it. Facts don't care about your feelings, right? It's true. And so the next step is to say that the human mind can't comprehend this. So the question is, if 2 + 2 = 4 didn't come from the human mind and it exists eternally on its own, what could have produced 2 + 2 = 4? If it couldn't come from our own brains and our own minds, where could it have come from? What do you think, Kirsten?
God.
Okay. How many of you agree? How many of you agree with that? 2 + 2 = 4, produced by God. If God produces 2 + 2 = 4, though, then 2 + 2 = 4 is no longer an eternal truth. Because how can you create something that's eternal? So what's the, do you see the issue there? If 2 + 2 = 4 has always existed, how can it be produced? Here's how Augustine solves the problem. Augustine says, what if instead of producing 2 + 2 = 4, there was an eternal mind that was always thinking, always containing the eternal truth of 2 + 2 = 4? So 2 + 2 = 4 is always there, but such a mind would have to be eternal itself if the truths it were possessing are eternal. So Augustine thinks that this line of reasoning strongly suggests an eternal being exists who sustains eternal truths. You follow? 2 + 2 = 4 for Augustine is not something that God creates. It's something that's always there, always being thought of, always being upheld in the mind of God. Right? Good? Maybe? Now we're getting somewhere. When we say that God is truth, we're not saying that God is 2 + 2 = 4. He's not. Instead, we're saying that God contains all of that of which is true. He is eternal. He is the one who has eternally existed. Because remember, God is not created, right? Amen. Not created. But in order for 2 + 2 = 4 to be this eternal, timeless truth, That means that somebody always had to be thinking that, always, when he spoke the universe into existence, right? I know, it's kind of Chris, what do you think? The argument goes like this. Premise one. If there's something unchanged and not created by human minds, then God exists. Premise two. Truth is unchanging and not created by human minds. 2 + 2 = 4 was not produced by our own minds. It was discovered. Therefore, God exists. So he's taking these timeless truths and he's saying there's no way that a mind, a created mind, could possibly produce this. It had to be found. It had to be located in the realm of mathematics. And instead, the only one who could actually contain the essence of this is an eternal being. And therefore, God exists. What do you guys think? What do you think? Does it kind of make sense? Yeah. Okay.
Like, it's no longer a chicken or the egg question. It's like there was somebody always eternal with a mind that was first.
Right.
Not even first, just always.
He's just always there. Because it's mind-bending to think about eternity, because in our brains, there always has to be some sort of set beginning. That's just how we're created. We're created beings. But the only one who can contain this truth is God. An eternal mind has to contain eternal truths. Does that make sense? This is what I really think, that this part of what the writer of Hebrews says when Jesus is upholding the universe by what? By the word of his power. That's how that... Jesus is all truth. The logos is contained in him. He is containing 2 + 2 = 4. He's containing the laws of logic. He's containing mathematics and the metaphysical and that and everything that exists in the realm of Plato's ideas. It's Christ. It's God. It's the Godhead. It's the Trinity. He is the only one that can contain 2 + 2 = 4. It has to be discovered. It can't be produced. We would never produce such a thing. It's always there. So, this is Augustine again, kind of concluding his argument. He said, "You granted that I showed you something higher than our minds, you would admit, assuming that nothing which existed was still higher, that God exists. I accepted your condition and said it was enough to show this. For if there is something more excellent than truth, this is God. If there is not, then the truth itself is God." Then he says, whether or not truth is God, you cannot deny that God exists. And this was the question that we agreed to deal. So he's basically saying, you have to admit that because 2 + 2 = 4 is an eternal truth, that there is some sort of eternal being that exists. Questions? I know that's a lot. We could only get to Augustine today. We're moving to the medieval era, so we'll cover Aquinas, and then we'll cover the modern era, which is René Descartes, who famously said, "I think, therefore I am," which pretty much began modernism and the Enlightenment era. And then we'll move to postmodernism, and then we'll get into foundational definitions of absolute truth and the concept of truth. So that's where we're going like the next 2 weeks. Does that make sense? Okay, this was a lot. This is like probably the most heady class we've ever had. But I think it's important to understand that when we understand this and when we see how the Holy Spirit through the writers of the Bible took this concept of the Logos and said, yeah, it's that and it's way more. It's everything. It's Christ, right? He is the word. He is the truth. That's what that means, that Christ embodies it. And so therefore, we can now we can now reason. We can now discover eternal truths and have a source for that. We can point back to and say, 2 + 2 = 4. Couldn't come from me. Couldn't be me. Has to be an eternal being. And again, it's not that God necessarily creates it. It's that he eternally contains it. Cool.